The music business has always projected a glamorous image of creativity and artistic freedom, but behind the curtain lies a shadow empire of intimidation, payola, and mob connections. In 1978, a loose alliance of independent promoters called the Network formed, creating a system of institutionalized payola that would reshape the entire industry. Key figures like Joseph Isgrow and Fred DiCipio controlled territories across America, delivering national airplay through a sophisticated system of bribes and favors. By 1985, record labels were spending $60 to $80 million annually on indie promotion, nearly 30% of the industry's pre-tax profits, not because it guaranteed hits, but because refusing to pay guaranteed failure. This system created a stark divide among industry executives. CBS Records president Walter Yetnikoff embraced the indies as mensches who get results, while his deputy Dick Asher worried about organized crime connections. The promotion system operated through carefully constructed invoices with tear-off receipts that were discarded after verification, leaving no paper trail connecting payments to specific radio stations. This wasn't just promotion, it was extortion, demonstrated dramatically when the network blocked Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall from major Los Angeles radio stations until CBS hired them. Morris Levy, known as the Octopus and the Godfather, built a $75 million empire through his 30,000 copyright publishing company, understanding that hit songs meant perpetual revenue. His influence came from both business acumen and extensive mafia connections, particularly with the Genovese family. Though he publicly denied mob ties, Levy's criminal connections began at 14 when he befriended future Genovese head Tommy Eboli. He later allied with Gaetano Corky Vastola and maintained a lifelong friendship with Vincent the Chin Giaconte from their Bronx days. A defiant character who quit school after dumping ink on a teacher who mocked his welfare status, Levy was known for ruthless practices like claiming others' songwriting credits and seizing John Lennon's unfinished Oldies album. Despite a 1988 extortion conviction, he remained respected until his death in 1990, having sold his music holdings for over $55 million. By the mid-1980s, three titans dominated the music industry: Walter Yetnikoff, CBS Records; David Geffen, Geffen Records; and Irving Azoff, MCA Records. Their fierce rivalries shaped the industry landscape. Geffen diversified into film successes like Risky Business and Beetlejuice, along with Broadway hits like Dreamgirls and Cats. From his deliberately casual office, he candidly admitted, "I'm basically in the David Geffen business." The diminutive Azoff was notorious for his dramatic tantrums, destroying hotel rooms, setting menus on fire, and once sending a live boa constrictor to an enemy with a note, "Now you have two of them." Artists loved him for manufacturing conflicts with record companies, then heroically resolving them. Their rivalry climaxed during CBS's lawsuit against Boston's Tom Scholz. After Boston's attorney leaked negotiations to MCA, Azoff swooped in with an offer. Yetnikoff countered by suing all parties involved. The saga ended with Boston's third stage releasing on MCA in 1986, selling 4 million copies. Record industry contracts heavily favored labels, making most costs recoupable against artist royalties rather than gross receipts. This allowed labels to profit while artists remained in debt. Patti Smith's Scandal earned just $100,000 from a million-selling album. Labels routinely underpaid royalties, with one audit manager admitting he'd never seen an artist overpaid. Attorney Alan Grubman became an industry powerhouse, representing over 30% of CBS Records pop roster, including Springsteen, Joel, Madonna, and Sting. Despite mediocre law school performance and disliking rock music, his warm personality and deal-making skills distinguished him. His relationship with Walter Yetnikoff proved vital but subservient, demonstrated when Grubman knelt during a Billy Joel negotiation while Walter destroyed his shirt. Walter steered clients to Grubman, knowing he'd be more compliant than other attorneys, an arrangement benefiting both men. By 1988, Grubman's influence culminated in earning $1 million as an investment banker in MCA's purchase of Winterland from CBS. Neil Bogart's Casablanca Records embodied disco's excesses. After success with Bubblegum Pop at Buddha Records, he launched Casablanca in 1973, surviving early struggles through Donna Summer's breakthrough hit. By 1976, with Summer, Kiss, and Parliament, the label reached $55 million in revenue. The label's offices, modeled after Rick's Cafe from Casablanca, became infamous for debauchery, featuring constant music, nepotistic hiring, and open drug use during meetings. Former employee Danny Davis called it the worst experience of my life. When PolyGram invested $10 million for half ownership in 1977, they mistook temporary success for sustainability. Despite huge revenues from Saturday Night Fever and Grease in 1978, massive overproduction, including millions of unsold Kiss solo albums, led to minimal profits. The market's contraction proved devastating. By 1979, Casablanca struggled as the Village People declined, Kiss faded, and Donna Summer prepared to leave. PolyGram bought the remaining 50% and ousted Bogart with a $15 million buyout in 1980. Bogart died of cancer in 1982, his financial failures overshadowing his artistic legacy. Walter Yetnikoff's power at CBS Records peaked after firing Dick Asher in 1983. Michael Jackson's Thriller became a phenomenon, selling 38.5 million copies. When Jackson won 7 Grammys in 1984, he brought Walter on stage, cementing Yetnikoff as his rabbi. By 1985, Walter's influence secured him an extraordinary CBS contract, $250,000 signing bonus and $475,000 base salary. Despite success, his immigrant fear of poverty drove an obsession with wealth. After orchestrating CBS Records' sale to Sony for $10 million plus equity, Walter appointed Tommy Mottola as CBS Records' U.S. head. However, his alcoholism reached crisis levels by mid-1989, and post-rehab, his behavior became increasingly unstable. He began destroying key relationships, attacking Bruce Springsteen, alienating Alan Grubman, and severing ties with David Geffen through homophobic comments and refusing to release a Michael Jackson track for Geffen's Days of Thunder soundtrack. Geffen, as Jackson's advisor, then worked to separate the two. Sony announced Yetnikoff's departure in 1990, ending his 15-year reign. As David Geffen noted, Walter slit his own throat. His story reflects the industry's shift from artist development to a business driven by ego and excess. Behind the power struggles and corporate battles, we sometimes forget the music industry's core purpose, the music itself. While executives fought over market share and artists battled exploitative contracts, they were inadvertently shaping the soundtrack of generations. The tragedy revealed in Hitman isn't just the corruption, but how business interests consistently overshadowed the art. The power broker's stories expose a stark reality. The music that defined our lives was often treated as mere product by those controlling its distribution. Yet somehow, transcendent art still emerged, not because of the industry structure, but despite it. What's most striking isn't how much the music business has changed since Hitman, but how much remains the same. Though digital distribution has transformed the landscape, the core tensions between art and commerce, creators and distributors persist. The players change, but the struggle for control and profits endures.